Somehow I have to start with the Enlightenment, the 18th century, where modern European history and cultural history really starts. And so I have to lay the foundations for the two great movements which are at the start of modern European cultural history, the Enlightenment and the religious revival, pietism and evangelism. And we are now about to talk about the Enlightenment first, and then we talk about pietism and evangelism. And what I said last time about the difference between popular culture and the culture of the intellectuals applies here. Popular culture will go into the religious revival, obviously. And the culture of the intellectuals will be the culture of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, Nathan the Wise and so on, won't touch the people as such. It won't penetrate very deep. You'll see why, I think, when you read it. We'll talk about it. But the religious culture, of course, penetrated down among the people, properly speaking. So that we are concerned now with the prehistory. And I was starting to talk about Pascal, because I want to take Pascal's Pensée of 1660, that famous book, as a kind of summary of the dialectic between religion and doubt, which in a way stands at the beginning of the Enlightenment. Pascal, the last great intellectual Christian summary, really the last great intellectual Christian summary, I think, which combines doubt and faith in, as yet, a Christian universe. The background for Pascal is again, on the one hand, the unsettling effects of the modernization process. In Pascal himself, you will see, a personalized Christianity becomes oddly abstract, and that is happening in the whole of Europe. The absolute monarchy becomes abstract. I've talked to you about that. A world of myth and symbols arises instead of a world that is personalized, ever more abstract world. The image of the chain of being, which Pascal uses, and I ended with last time, is only understandable as part of a totality of things. When Pascal talks about the chain of being, that everything is cause and effect, depending and supporting, mediate and immediate, everything is held together by an imperceptible chain which binds together things most different and most distant. That is to say, everything from God and Christ to the angels and the cherubs down to men, down to the higher beasts, the lower beasts, the lesser devils, the most devils, that everything is bound together. There cannot be a missing link. We shall come to the search for that sort of thing later. There cannot be a missing link. For Pascal, this is depersonalized now. He doesn't talk about anymore the devil, and he doesn't talk anymore about the stars as angels and all of that sort of thing, which personalizes the universe. But instead, he talks about a totality. Christianity is seeing things, as I said last time, in a totality. And that, in a sense, is the clue, really, to all of Pascal, as you will see. You must see everything in a kind of total framework. You must first grasp the whole before you can grasp the part. Instead of building up, as people are wont to, popular culture builds up from little things. I told you that's why people collect knickknacks, yes? Your symbolism is in little things, by and large, you know. Regan cushions and I don't know what else, yes? You know, you don't have chamber pots anymore. But all of these things, you see, which you have therefore here, people build up. But for Pascal and for the Enlightenment, and in a sense for modern Marxism, for modernity, it always is the effort to grasp an impersonalized universe, to grasp the totality of things, as you will see. And in Pascal, this becomes the basic problem. His emphasis, on the one hand, is on the power of man. And on the other hand, it is on the totality of things. On the one hand, for Pascal, man has the power of reason. Man is a reasoning animal. It's true for all of Catholicism, as well as Pascal, for Protestantism too. But what is really the task of reason? What is the task of reason? And this is 267. I'm now going to give you the paragraphs. They're all labeled, no matter what edition you have, the same. The last proceeding of reason is to recognize that there is an infinity of things that are beyond it. In other words, the task of reason is to grasp that things are beyond reason, because the task of reason is to grasp the totality. And the totality for Pascal is the infinite, the infinite. Now, in a sense, this is good Catholic dogma. Reason goes so far, and then you have a leap of faith. That is, reason takes you so far. But to grasp ultimate things in Christianity, you have to make a leap of faith. To grasp the totality, God and Christ, providence, if you like, to use a Christian term here, providence, you have to make a leap of faith. And Pascal really makes this leap of faith in a way, and what he says, the task of reason is to grasp things that are really beyond reason. The whole must be grasped before you can understand the part. Now, this makes a basic tension in man, and this is the basic tension in Pascal, a basic paradox between human nature on the one hand, man as a thinking animal, if you like, as an animal who thinks, who uses his reason, who wants to grasp things with his reason. Because Pascal is already modern enough to believe that reason wants to reach out all the time and grasp everything. That's already the Enlightenment. That's already pretty modern. Reason wants to grasp everything. But reason can't grasp everything. It can't grasp what is so important. It can't grasp the totality. And that is, after all, what really counts. As Pascal puts it in number 672, and if you ever look at it, paragraph 72 is the key paragraph. Really start with that, because here is the tension. And it is called man's disproportion. And by disproportion, he thinks that reason always outreaches man. Let man then contemplate the whole of nature in her full and grand majesty, and turn his vision from the low objects which surround him. Let him gaze on that brilliant light, set an eternal lamp to illumine the universe. Let the earth appear to him a point in comparison with the vast circle described by the sun. And let him wonder at the fact that this vast circle is itself but a very fine point in comparison with that described by the stars in their revolution around the firmament. But if our view be arrested there, let our imagination pass beyond. It will sooner exhaust the power of conception than nature, that of supplying material for conception. The whole visible world is only an imperceptible atom in the ample bosom of nature. No idea approaches it. We may enlarge our conceptions beyond all imaginable space. We only produce atoms in comparison with the reality of things. It is an infinite sphere, the center of which is everywhere, the circumference of which is nowhere. In short, it is the greatest sensible mark of the almighty power of God. Now, what is he really saying here? He's saying there are no fixed boundaries. Therefore, reason can't grasp it. There are no fixed boundaries. It's an infinite sphere. The center is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere. And of course, this is impossible for man really to accept. And so you get this tension. You must contemplate the brilliant light, but the brilliant light is the totality, which has no borders, no circumference. You see how this was built up, always to a greater and greater, always to a vaguer and vaguer unit, if you like to put it that way, always to a vaguer and vaguer unit until you come to the totality. And the totality is not nature yet. It isn't even the stars. It is God. Here you see again the chain of being. First Pascal gets you to the vastness of nature. Then he gets you to the vastness of the stars. And then finally he gets you to the vastness of God. But in Pascal you can already not really grasp the vastness of nature. How much less can you grasp the vastness of God? Now man, therefore, is always part of this whole universe. And though his thought always reaches to grasp the whole, he can really understand only the part. He cannot understand the whole. He can understand only the part. And that is, as it were, the great problem. If we look at paragraph 267, which is again central 267, the last proceeding of reason is to recognize that there is an infinity of things which are beyond it. It is but feeble if it does not see so far as to know it. In other words, knowledge is to know that you can't know. Knowledge is really to know by your reason that there are things that you can't know. And that is the great paradox. That is the great uncertainty. That is, in a way, the great tension. And therefore, the world must go, in a way, beyond the geometrical, the mathematical. He is really replying, but we have no time to go into that, to Descartes, to Descartes' world, which is a mathematical, definable world. I'll come back to that eventually. A world that you can grasp. In other words, he is opposed to seeing the beauty of man through the flea, as the Enlightenment once put it. That is to say that you can get at the infinite universe through scientific investigation, and that the natural laws you can grasp through dissecting the most minuscule thing, and that you go through the most minuscule to totality. Here you jump direct to totality. The result is rather famous. The result is, what is Christianity then? What is Christianity? And this is 234, paragraph 234, and this is what people have called Pascal's famous wager. Christianity is a bet. It's a wager. It's playing the lottery, if you like. It's playing the lottery. For this is how Pascal puts it, what Christianity is. If we must not act save on a certainty, we ought not to act on religion, for it is not certain. And here, it can't be certain, because you cannot grasp it by your reason. So it is always uncertain. But how many things we do on an uncertainty? Sea voyages, battles. I say then, we must do nothing at all, for nothing is certain. And that there is more certainty in religion than there is as to whether we may see tomorrow. For it is not certain that we may live to see tomorrow. And it is certainly possible that we may not live to see tomorrow. We cannot say as much about religion. It is not certain that it is, but who will venture to say that it is possible that it is not? Now, when we work for tomorrow, and so on an uncertainty, we act reasonably. For we ought to work for an uncertainty according to the doctrine of chance. In other words, what Pascal is really saying is, we're always really living uncertain, because we may die today. We may not live to see tomorrow. And sea voyages, battles, everything we do, he says, actually uncertain. If we only have to act on a certainty, we shouldn't act at all. But religion is more certain, because at least there is the possibility of it. The possibility that we don't see tomorrow, we can never grasp in any way. And it's very possible that we shall die today. But religion is a matter of degree. It is more possible. And therefore, religion has to be uncertain. Now, there are two more remarks I want to make here in a more general framework. From now on in, this idea of religion as a wager, just as you wager, you will live today and you will live to see tomorrow, will be a very important trend in modern religion, totally opposed to popular piety. But it will be a trend not only in Christianity, but in Judaism, with the Kabbalah, with Gershom Scholem, in Judaism, and it brings religion into the vicinity of nihilism. There is a trend in Christianity and Judaism which makes them really nihilistic. It is a wager. It is uncertainty. Therefore, we cannot support any certainty. And this trend of religion, of course, of religion as uncertain, as revolutionary, if you like. My friend Scholem always voted for the Communist Party, therefore. And it brings Christianity and Judaism into the vicinity of revolution and certainly of nihilism. And it becomes an intellectual thing only, obviously, but a very important one. It will, of course, by and large, be defeated. It never had a chance, because religion will be popular in the religious revival because it is a certainty. Because it is a certainty. And religion will eventually ally itself with every dictatorship imaginable because it has to be a certainty. And it will make its great alliance with nationalism, with chauvinism, whether in Israel or elsewhere, because nationalism and chauvinism is a certainty. It makes people feel good. It's a certainty. They know where they are. So that religion actually goes the other way, I'm afraid, from Pascal in history. It plays on a certainty. And eventually, when next time I come to the first great critique of Christianity by Pierre Bayle, he answers Pascal. And he makes a point, Pierre Bayle makes a point, which will be the point which I'm afraid will eventually triumph and will eventually win out, which must be clear to you. He said, religion, says Bayle, tongue-in-cheek, obviously, tongue-in-cheek. He is against all religion. He is against everything, as you will see. He is the first one to push doubt to the greatest length conceivable. He says, ironically, yes, religion ought to be based on a certainty. Its effect, its usages collapse as soon as the firm conviction of its truth is erased from the mind. In other words, Bayle makes the point, ironically, religion depends on truth. Truth is certainty. Pascal says, no, religion doesn't depend on truth defined that way at all, because we have no way of grasping it with our reason. Therefore, it's a wager. We are really wagering religion is truth. We must live in a universe of uncertainty. That will be put to its final conclusion by Nietzsche eventually. But by Nietzsche's time, religion was so discredited that Nietzsche, of course, did never consider religion as part of, if you like, a universe of doubt, a universe where you have to accept uncertainty. By Nietzsche, by 1900, religion had gone so much the path of certainty and truth and supports for truth of all sorts of things that Nietzsche didn't even consider it. He took it for granted that if you are for uncertainty, you are against religion. And only these days, only now, really, and especially in Judaism, much less in Christianity, to Christianity only with Kierkegaard in some regards, we shall see, but not in all, do you have this idea of nihilism. Of nihilism, that religion is really a form of nihilism, of uncertainty. Now, man's reason, therefore, is not powerless. It cannot grasp the whole. Now, Pascal adds a second argument to this, and that is a very modern argument already, namely that anyhow, how can you grasp the universe if life is constantly changing? In other words, he already saw what I've talked about so much, that there was constant change in life, in politics, in social structure, in the modernization of Europe. And so on paragraph 266, he tells it to you, and he tells it to you in the change of astronomy. I'll come back to that, which pioneered the change. The astronomers. The astronomers, of course, pioneered the change. They unsettled the stars. And if you know your Shakespeare, Shakespeare even appeals to the stars in heaven, you know, to keep the hierarchy on Earth intact. But 17th century astronomy told you all sorts of awful things. It told you that stars were going in an elliptical circle. Who can imagine an elliptical circle? And it unsettled the universe, you know. How could they be angels if they behaved in such a stupid way? So what you have, therefore, here is an unsettled universe. And Pascal in 1660 takes that into consideration. How many stars have telescopes revealed to us which did not exist for our philosophers of old? We freely attack Holy Scripture on the great number of stars, saying there are only 1,028. We know it. There is grass on the earth, and on the grass are leaves, and on these leaves are animals. And now we know more about these animals. In other words, science is changing our conception of the universe. That's, of course, what was happening. Newton, astronomy, changing our conception. And in 1660, Pascal was totally aware of what we call the scientific revolution, yes? Totally aware of it. And then he says, "O presumptuous man, here is a fine reflection. We must not say that there's anything we do not see." In other words, man is presumption. We think we know the universe. But in reality, it's a wager. God knows what may be revealed tomorrow. God knows what may be revealed tomorrow. So how can we say that our reason can grasp everything if our reason cannot even grasp what nature is like or what the stars are like or what our surroundings are like? Because God knows what may be revealed tomorrow. Tomorrow it may be revealed, I don't know what. I don't know astronomy, so I can never think of an example. But you know what I mean is quite clear, yes? And so Pascal supported scientific enterprise. He was a great scientist, don't forget. I told you, he discovered the first computer, the model of all computers. He was a scientist. And so he was very much aware of this, of course. But he used it as an additional argument that religion must be uncertainty, because for him in the scientific revolution, everything is unsettled, and how much more later with the communications revolution, with all of the things that I have told you about. This, I think, is also very clear. Now, he sums this up, and we must sum it up. As Pascal puts it, therefore, going back really to Christian ideas, basic Christian ideas. Man, therefore, he says, is a reed, but a feeble reed. He surpasses himself in power of thought, power of intuition, and imagination. But how really does man distinguish himself from animal? There's only one way that man distinguishes himself from animal. Man recognizes his misery. Animals don't. And what is man's misery? That he always tries to outreach himself. That his reason always tries to outreach, if you like, the universe. And that, therefore, Pascal ends, of course, with an extremely tragic view of God. And here again, we can summarize it. First of all, the most famous paragraph in all of Pascal, paragraph 347. Man is but a reed, but the most feeble thing in nature. This is Christian humility. But the most feeble thing in nature. But he is a thinking reed. The entire universe need not arm itself to crush him. A vapor, a drop of water suffices to kill him. But if the universe were to crush him, man would still be more noble than that which killed him, because he knows that he dies, and the advantages with the universe is over him. The universe knows nothing about this. In other words, what makes man superior to earthquakes, thunders, and animals is his self-consciousness. And here something comes into history which will haunt us from this day to this, the importance of consciousness. Now, that was always latent in Christianity in some way, but it will become a big issue in Marxism and a big issue in all modern thought. Where is man's consciousness? How powerful is man's consciousness? And Pascal already makes articulate what is always inherent, really, in Christianity from the beginning, namely that man is distinguished from nature and the animals by his consciousness. And he equates reason and consciousness. And that equation is already of the Enlightenment. The equation that Pascal makes almost inarticulately, almost without spelling it out, but which comes from the scientific revolution, really, the equation of reason and consciousness. And so man is conscious, but what is he conscious of? He is conscious of his misery. Now, here I could go into a long talk of the religion which Catholic sect which Pascal belonged to, the Jansenist. And the Jansenist sect, about whom I don't want to say anything here, the Jansenist sect had a tragic view of life. They were a Catholic Renaissance, really a Catholic Renaissance of the 17th century, which comes before the Protestant Renaissance of the 18th century. But the Catholic Renaissance of the 17th century was in a way a reaction against triumphant Rome. Because in the 17th century, Rome, as you see it today, was built. Showy, triumphant, Baroque Rome. The 17th century, the great century of the triumph of the church, the daughter of the great scourge of Catholicism, King Gustavus Adolphus, Queen Christina converts to Catholicism, enters Rome, and much of Rome, the whole Piazza del Popolo in the Baroque is built for the entry of Queen Christina, the daughter of the chief Protestant, coming back, as it were, into the fold. So what you have, it is a ever more triumphant church, which was crushing Protestantism. The 17th century is when Poland became Catholic again. So it was crushing Protestantism. And against that, Pascal and the Catholic revival revolted, tried to make it again an inward thing. So they stressed what? Humility and charity. The great Catholic saint, whom you all only know from the boxes next to the supermarkets in Madison, where you put old clothes like that in, St. Paul. The great saints, yes? The great saints who stress charity. St. Vincent de Paul, for example, who stressed charity. These great saints, charity and humility. And to Pascal, this becomes of the essence again. Against Baroque Rome. It's a tract written against the wonderful Rome you see today. The Baroque, the triumphant church. And so the center of it is really the greatness of man is that he cannot recognize his misery. And paragraph 348, which is headed a thinking reed. You know what is a reed, if you don't, I won't explain it. It is not, man is a reed, but a thinking reed. Man is swallowed by the universe like an atom. In other words, he is a drop, a raindrop. He can be crushed. Well, certainly you can be crushed. A flower pot, I always say. When people always say to me, it's dangerous to walk in New York or God knows what, I say, well, in Madison, a flower pot can fall on me and I'm dead, yes? So, in other words, all of this can happen, yes? All of this can happen and you can be crushed at any moment, yes? Obviously, but it's something people want to forget, and so you get the importance of religious liturgy as a safeguard in popular culture. What I said, the books of prophecy, the certainty of coming to Christ in the end, the certainty of being reborn, and eventually the alliance of religion with respectability, and we should see a lot of it, people classified into normal and abnormal, sexually and otherwise, because of the alliance of religion with respectability, which is, of course, still today, I don't have to tell you, the alliance of religion with respectability and the alliance of religion with nationalism, and all of this comes up. Yes, yes. Respectability, nationalism, outward dress becomes very important for religion, haircut and all that sort of thing. Yes, even before it became merely a social thing. So, as it's apt to be, I'm afraid, today. So what you have, therefore, is clear. You have Pascal on the one hand and the Catholic Renaissance, and on the other hand, this revival of popular culture, as it were, Pascal with his tragic view of the world. Now, it is this tension that the average man wants to escape from. The really great, he says, reject the search for security. While the average man, he says, wants to be amused. He wants security. He wants to be amused. Pascal was obviously what we would call today a cultural snob, yes? There's no question about that. The average man wants to be amused. He was quite clear that his was not a Christianity for the average man, and on this I think you can read very well on, paragraph 139, find it, you can read quite clearly that the average man wants nothing more than to be amused, as it were, wants nothing more than to, and it's headed diversion. Yes? Diversion. Hence it comes that play and the society of women, war, and high posts are so thought after. Well, women as a game, a plaything. I shall have a lot to say about women lately, later, and the status of women, but that will tell you something. Obviously, the Jansenists lived semi-monastic life, I should say that. Even if they weren't in orders, they lived a semi-monastic life. So hence it comes that play and the society of women, war, and high posts are sought after. Not that there is, in fact, any happiness in them, or that men imagine true bliss to consist in money won at play, or in the hare which they hunt, or in the women which they take. We would not take these as a gift. We do not seek that easy and peaceful lot which permits us to think of which permits us not to think of our unhappy condition. Hence it comes that men love noise and stir. Hence it comes that the prison is so horrible a punishment. Hence it comes that the pleasure of solitude is a thing incomprehensible. And it is, in fact, the greatest source of happiness in the condition of kings that men try incessantly to divert them and to procure for them all sorts of pleasure. In other words, it's quite clear his criticism. All these pleasures are to stop you from thinking that you are just a drop in the universe, that you cannot understand it, that you are uncertainty, that life is a verger, you drown it, you deaden, you become numb. And in this, of course, there is a very great truth, which I don't want to minimize. After all, we are numbed today. We are numbed today. We never think of consequences. Otherwise, nobody would support atomic rearmament. If you ever think of the consequences of what we're doing, you would never support it. But people are numbed. People are numbed by mass war in our time. People are numbed by catastrophe. You just don't think about it. You think how charming our president is on television. But you don't think about the consequences of an atomic bomb. That would never occur to you. So then, in other words, Pascal, of course, has got, as it were, the truth, I think, of much of modern history. Not criticizing anybody today. I think this is a truth of modern history. It is a truth of modern history, that is all. It is a truth of modern history that we intend to sublimate the real uncertainties, the real catastrophe, in liturgy, in certainties like the nation, like nationalism, and religion. That we grasp for certainties in an uncertain world, and that in a sense determines what will be successful in popular culture and unsuccessful, and that determines what will be successful in politics and unsuccessful in politics as well. And that determines, of course, the rise of the greatest political force of modern times, nationalism. And that determines the rise of the other greatest force of modern times, respectability, which comes out of the evangelical movement, the shame of your bodies, the shame of sexuality, and the classification of people into normal and abnormal. That is part of wanting security. And it only arises in the 18th century. It only arises in the 18th century. Before the 18th century, there is no modern nationalism, and there is no modern respectability either. So you would be very surprised and, I think, shocked eventually when we come to these kind of changes. There was a tolerance about the human body, about sexual preference and habits, that was quite unknown after the 18th century. Totally unknown after the 18th century. So what you get is that Pascal, in a sense, is the last one who puts forward a kind of open universe before, under the pressure of industrialization, I think, modernization, the universe closes off and people get numbed to catastrophe. Eventually, of course, the numbing is helped by taking photographs, the pictures, above all, the Jewish Holocaust. All the sting is drawn from it because all you see is pictures. And when you see a picture, you really draw the sting from something because you frame it. You frame it. It's like a knick-knack. You know, all these museums of the Jewish Holocaust, they're nothing else but knick-knacks. It degrades it to a knick-knack. You see these pictures, and as you see the picture, you get a certain distance from the event. You cut it down to size. As I said before, the general sense is either to make things sacred or to trivialize them. And this is, of course, what Pascal is against, to trivialize religion or to make it sacred. Now, all of this, I hope I have made myself more or less clear of what Pascal is all about here and what he is trying to tell us. Now, already at the time of Pascal, there were some who went further than Pascal, who really accepted Pascal's idea of uncertainty, but who denied even the wager, though they could not do that officially, and who through this denial got into a bind, which is very typical for what we are about to deal with. For from Pascal now, I must go to Pierre Bayle. And Pierre Bayle's Historical and Critical Dictionary of 1697, you see, somewhat later, right at the threshold of the Enlightenment. Pierre Bayle's Historical and Critical Dictionary at the threshold of the Enlightenment at 1697 became the arsenal of the Enlightenment. The ammunition against Christianity of the Enlightenment came from Bayle. Very largely. Bayle became the arsenal of ammunition to shoot against Christianity by Voltaire and everybody else. Because what Bayle does essentially, he relativizes everything. He goes beyond Pascal, and he goes on it on the basis of doubt. For the essence of the scientific revolution and the essence of the attack of Christianity is based on skepticism, on doubt. It is part of the history of skepticism. But Bayle is a landmark there, a basis of doubt, of the history of skepticism, to doubt ever more and more. And this emphasis on doubt becomes an emphasis on the critical mind and the essence of the Enlightenment. However you define the 18th century, the Enlightenment in France, however you define it, its emphasis is on the critical mind. That is the essence of the Enlightenment. And this emphasis on the critical mind, on the necessity of a critical mind, comes from doubt directed against Christianity. Rejecting, as it were, even the wager of Pascal. Doubt, sheer doubt, is what becomes important. Now, before I come to Bale, which I will do next time, there is one more remark I want to make, which falls into the gray zone between a substantial and an operative remark. I don't regard any administration as substantial. Between substantial and operative. Now, obviously, there are a certain kind of historians. They're the historians who believe that history must done of itself, alone. And you'll see why I say this. And I'm not one of them. I believe that history is relevant. So that from time to time I shall make remarks to tie it in with what I think is relevant today, like I did just now about the atomic bomb. And with these remarks, I hope you can disagree as much as you want to. I am doing this partly because I believe it, which doesn't mean that it's true. It may be totally false. I don't make any claims to truth in these matters. Because I believe it, but also for another reason. Because I think that learning history is not meaningful to you at all unless it speaks to you in some personal terms. And as it must speak to you in some personal terms, I do think this is important. And I'm saying this numbing process, what I said in all this, not so much as to put before you an eternal truth. This I can't do anyhow. Yes? I'm not a clergyman. And even they don't do it anymore. And if I were a clergyman, I would be closer to Pascal than anything else. So anyway, I don't come to you because of eternal truth, but I am doing this for an educational purpose, namely to show you that what we are dealing with is not so far removed from problems which are faced and which are a serious problem, of which I guess there are three serious problems which Pascal raises. The problem of living in uncertainty, which is only raised as well by Nietzsche. Only Nietzsche raises it as well as Pascal, I think myself. Again, that's a purely subjective judgment, as all these things are. But secondly, the thing that Pascal really raises is, of course, questions about the power of man and the power of reason. But he was optimistic about reason, as the entire Enlightenment is optimistic about reason. He was optimistic about reason. But on the other hand, it is true that he raises a problem which most people and religion and politics will solve by putting forward new certainties for old. And the new certainties are what we call respectability. They're what we call nationalism. Certain things, as you will see, in the religious revivals, new certainties for old. Because man cannot live in uncertainty. You can't really be a Nietzschean, yes? And it's very difficult to be a Pascalian man too, I dare say, yes? And it's virtually impossible, as you'll see, to be a Balian. But it is certainly possible. And finally, even the Enlightenment put forward certainties. It used doubt for certainty, only they were non-Christian certainties. And I think it'll help you if you remember that. Even the Enlightenment put forward two certainties. Two authorities. I could say authority for certainty, yes? Two authorities, which to them were immutable. The classics and the laws of nature. They, to them, were reflections of God in a way. Immutable. One became a principle of science, and one became a principle of beauty. Because you still today, you judge beautiful looks by the classics. How much a person, especially men, and we're not with women yet, we'll be later. They don't have much to say at this moment, unfortunately, in history, as you can see by that remarkable quotation of Pascal. Yes, terrible. So I've come to that later. But obviously, the classics and natural law will be new authority. For it is true, and let me say that before I end, it is quite true that no movement has succeeded in history over a long period of time, which has not appealed to authority, which has not given people certainty. And I would go further and I would say which has not personalized this certainty in myths and symbols. No movement has succeeded, because you cannot be a Nietzschean man or a Nietzschean woman. You love certainties. You love certainties. I love certainties. Why am I different? I'm no different. I live by certainties, yes? I personalize everything. I personalize my dog. I personalize everything, yes? I don't happen to have many knickknacks around, or I have a sort of knickknacks around. But anyway, so I wanted to say in the end that you must know the basis. And the basis is a certain subjectivity, which I hope you will question, because this enterprise would have no sense at all if I didn't induce, at least in some of you, a critical mind. You must not take anything for granted. When any of your elders say something, you must question it immediately, because everything is in history. The way you dress, the way you look, the way you think, everything is determined historically. So you can question damned everything. I hope you do. Anyhow, we go to Bale, who did. He wasn't too effective, so I don't know.